working of the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. Committee Legislative Assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Szymanski?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson? Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom? Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Lane is excused. Representative Lesh? Representative Liebling? Representative Mazurel?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Tilbury is excused. Representative Vogel?
Here.
And Representative Wardlow?
Chair notes that a quorum is present. Before we proceed with the minutes and our agenda, I'd like to introduce to the committee and to our audience, we have a new committee legislative assistant with us. Will be with us for the balance of our session. Her name is Erin Eden. All right. Minutes from the last meeting are in the packet, February 17th. May I have a motion to approve those minutes?
I'll move that.
Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes for February 17, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Minutes of February 17th are approved. What we're going to do, committee, is go straight to the budget overviews. House File 152, Representative Cornish, criminal possession or sale of identification documents, crime created, we're going to hold till the end of the meeting for a couple reasons. First of all, looks like Cornish is going to solo. Your witness did not show today. Furthermore, we'll hear the bill, and then the chair will lay it over for action at a later time, so we will not be voting on that. Members, also in your packet, you will see that I've submitted to the courts and the agencies over which this committee has oversight purview a request to help gather information for our consideration as we review the budget requests and recommendations. Included is a copy of the questions. It looks like this. If you want to pull it out and see the questions that we've asked the courts and the agencies, as we move through the process, we will continue to share all information we gather both during committee and afterwards. So with that, members, you'll see before you a black three-leaf, three-ring binder, rather. These are your budget books for this committee. You're welcome to leave them on the table, and they will be kept safe. Or if you take them as part of our cost-cutting measure, we're not going to replace them unless you beg real hard. So keep track of them. Take them home with you, but please try to keep track of them. The contents of these budget books are not necessarily in order of importance. They're just the way I've had them arranged. For instance, civil legal services is normally included in the Supreme Court budget pages, but that section has been moved toward the front of the book for your convenience, because we are taking them up today. So let's begin. We're going to deal with Sentencing Guidelines Commission first. And so I would like to call County Attorney Jeffrey Ekblad and Interim Director Jill Payne to present to the committee on behalf of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Welcome, and identify yourself and go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Payne. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Jeff Ekblad. I'm the Isanti County Attorney, and I'm the current chair of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to begin. I'm going to be using the budget information memo that was requested from the chair in my comments. And just briefly, as a reminder of what our commission does, the commission itself was enacted in law in 1978, and the commission maintains the guidelines that govern felony sentences in the state in order to support those goals of public safety, uniformity, truth and certainty, and proportionality. The governor's proposed biennial budget is $1,172,000 for the two-year biennium. The majority of that, 86%, is for salaries and benefits, and the other 14% is for operating costs. It's a slight reduction of 0.6% from the last biennium. And when we look at a more detailed view of the budget on page 2 of your memo, again, you'll notice that the majority of the budget is for salaries and benefits under that line 1A through E. Otherwise, for operating expenses, we have space rental and utilities and maintenance, and I have an asterisk there. That is because we have been told that our lease agreement for fiscal year 12 will actually go up, and then in fiscal year 13, our rent will be doubled at that time. You may recall from our overview when we were here a couple of weeks ago, we talked about some rent savings that we had produced from fiscal year 10 and 11. That's because at that time the agency moved to a state-owned building and we reduced our costs significantly at that time. Moving on in the detailed budget, I'll note that there's no costs or funding associated to out-of-state travel, overtime pay, employee development. And then when we look at items 2D and E, we have computer and IT and technical services. The majority of that is for our contract with the Office of Enterprise Technology, or I should say our interagency agreement with that group, and they provide our desktop support. In the memo itself, we have some line items in associated with 2D, outside vendors, and I'll assure you that we do not have any outside vendors. Last biennium, because we were not under the Office of Enterprise Technology, we did have some outside vendors who helped us with our networking and our desktop support. Continuing on to item 2F under communications, in that line we have our executive director's cell phone, we have our networking costs, our voice over IP cost, and our postage. In 2G, we have our in-state travel budget, which includes any outside metro area trainings that we do, and also the per diems that are provided to our commission members to come into St. Paul for the commission meetings. Under items 2J and K, equipment and supplies, the majority of that money is for the lease on our copier. And then, as I mentioned with the space rental, that being doubled by the beginning of fiscal year 13, we're going to need to cover that cost somehow. And one thought is that we would be moving money from other operating costs in the tune of $20,000 for the biennium up to that line item for space rental. But we are also investigating other ways that we can save on rental space. And I'll also note that in fiscal year 10 and 11, the agency saved the state over $28,000 in operating costs, and that money will be going back to the state's general fund at the end of this year. Continuing on to page 3 of your memo, and when we take a look at our FTEs and the structure of the commission staff, we have, again, 6 full-time employees, and then we have 1 part-time employee. That part-time position for Information Officer 2 is vacant. The position was intended to fund a two-phase project that would simplify the sentencing guidelines. The first phase of that project to improve on the formatting of the guidelines is complete. Phase 2 has not been completed yet, but the focus there is rewriting the language that would simplify and make it more user-friendly to our practitioners. The last person hired was in July of 2010, and that was for an entry-level researcher position. And then this is new and a change to your budget memo that we provided. Last week, the commission did interview for the permanent executive director position. We have an oral offer that is extended, and we're waiting for that to be accepted and for a written offer to be done. We're actually working on that today. In a more detailed look at the commission's FTEs and budget over time, over the last 10 years, in fiscal year 10 and 11, the commission did cut one FTE, going from 7 down to 6. The average FTEs over time is about 6.5 over the last 10 years. And then just for a moment, moving away from the memo, I just wanted to, as a reminder of how Minnesota ranks with compared to other sentencing commissions across the state, or excuse me, across the country. Minnesota has the second lowest number of FTEs and the second smallest budget of sentencing commissions in the country. We're lowest is Arkansas with 5 FTEs and a budget that is less than $1 million. The highest is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania does receive federal funding and is housed within a university, within Penn State University. And under item number 6 of the memo, when we talk about possible base budget reductions of 15% or 20%, we didn't have an opportunity to talk about this memo or different scenarios with our newly hired executive director, but when we talk about a 15% or 20% in terms of having a budget that is 86% salaries and benefits, most likely the cuts are going to come from staff. So under a 15% cut, we would most likely look at one full-time position and one part-time position being cut. That would mean we would discontinue that simplification, that user-friendly guide that we've been working towards. We would deny many requests for training when we go out state. We'd have to limit the guidelines assistance to the criminal justice partners, and that means, you may recall in our overview, that we provided phone consultations to over 2,500 phone calls basically a year, and that's to judges, to probation officers. So it could mean that a probation officer is looking for assistance on how to apply the sentencing guidelines, or a judge is in chambers and waiting to sentence a defendant and has questions about how to do that, how to apply the guidelines. That service would be affected. And a delay in response time to data requests and any additional research that we were asked to do would be affected. We would cut costs on operating expenses in the tune of about $1,500 because we just simply wouldn't have to support the desktop of those employees that were no longer there. We would have to consider unemployment insurance, though, and that may be offset there. And then again, we're looking at ways to, again, gain efficiencies and possibly move our offices to a cheaper location. If we talk about 20% reductions, we're looking most likely at cutting 2 full-time positions and 1 part-time position. Again, the simplification project would be affected. We would most likely deny the majority of requests for training unless it was something that we could do interactively with ITV. It would impact those phone calls, the sentencing guidelines assistance to our criminal justice partners, and denying many data requests that were not required of us by law. And then again, we would gain some efficiencies in operating expenses because we wouldn't have those desktops to support. But with either a 15% or a 20% reduction, the agency would need to focus on only its highest priority services, those of maintaining the guidelines, compiling accurate data on felony sentences, and providing fiscal notes to the legislature. The timeliness of the reporting, the data, would, however, be affected by any reductions. And thank you. I'm happy to try and answer any of your questions at this time.
Very good. Committee will now open the hearing to questions. I have a couple. Early on in your report, you suggested that you're investigating cost savings in future rentals. Could you explain that? What kind of cost savings are you looking for? What kind of future rentals?
Mr. Chair, we are working with the Department of Administration and their real estate management to look for cheaper options. Unfortunately, our building is one of the cheapest state-owned buildings, so it will be difficult to find anything that's less costly. However, we are in a very preliminary way looking at how we can gain some efficiencies with other state agencies, somehow barter for space, but we have been looking at that, and it hasn't actually reached any point where we have any success stories to announce here today, but we are working with the real estate management company.
If this doubling of your rent is inevitable and unavoidable, do you believe that you will find affordable accommodations elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's an excellent question. I don't think we can say at this time that we can secure that. And that's why we're looking at moving money from that other operating expenses to the rent category. So from that in the tune, again, of about $20,000 to cover that gap.
Also in your presentation, you suggested that Minnesota Sentencing Guideline Commission is second lowest of sentencing guideline commissions in the country. Remind me, refresh my memory, how many sentencing guidelines commissions do we have in the United States?
Mr. Chair, don't quote me on this, I should know, but I believe it's 24. And we did a comparison of those that are most like our state, so that we did just a snapshot of those that are closest to Minnesota's guidelines.
Another question. Do you have or perform any functions that are not statutorily required that may be contributing to your overall expense?
Mr. Chair, quite honestly, I don't believe that there's anything that's not within our purview that we are performing. I think we've gained a lot of efficiencies with our with the reports that we provide on our website. You know, before we accept any kind of a request from a practitioner to give them data, we direct them to our website. We have them look at the reports that are already produced by our agency. So I think that we do a pretty good job, and we are pretty lean in what we do.
A couple more questions relative to the expense line for vendor services. Can you go back over that and elaborate whether these are private contractor vendors or payments to other state agencies for services or both?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. If we look again at the detailed report of our budget, under lines 2D and 2D7, those professional technical services have been budgeted there, but when we talk to our new director, we're going to explain that those, that money needs to be shifted out of those funds and into that line 2E under computer and system services. So what we had before, before we moved our offices, we had a private outside vendor consulting with us on our networking and our desktop support. Since our move last April, we have been working with the state's Office of Enterprise Technology for those desktop support and networking services. So all of that, all of those funds have been shifted to that computer and system services line.
I have perhaps a final question. Go back over the communications of $7,000, and can you elaborate again what's covered and paid for with a little more breakdown?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll try and do that for you. Again, under line 2F in communications, we have the executive director's cell phone and that contract. We have our networking services, and that's our network line that we receive from the Office of Enterprise Technology. We have our voice over IP, so our phone service, and then our postage is within that budget line.
All right, questions from the committee? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a question for you, Mr. Chair. As we go through this budget line by line and look at these $5,000 items and talk about the cell phone, is it your intention for portions that you cut to cut the agency in a set dollar amount or percent amount, or is it your intention to do a line-by-line direction about, for example, cell phone service, copy service, those kinds of items?
Both. Representative Hillstrom, both options are on the table.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Greenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, are you currently under a hard freeze for salary and benefits? Or have you been in the last biennium?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, maybe you could help me understand your question when you say a hard freeze. You mean for as far as hiring? Excuse me.
Sure, Mr. Chair. A soft freeze is usually a freeze on salary. A hard freeze is a freeze on salary and benefits. Okay, that means that if your health insurance goes up as an employee, you pay the difference. There's no additional contribution from the employer. Okay, so a soft freeze, you usually get increases in benefits, but not in salary. Hard freeze, generally, everything is frozen. Benefits, you know, your benefit level, what you're getting, and also your salaries.
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so in response to your question about a hard freeze, it's something that our agency doesn't have direct responsibility for, but that's through the MMB. And I believe that there was projections done for those, for any increases that would be related to benefits. But that would be a question better answered by MMB.
Any other questions?
So, Mr. Chair, so if I, so have you had an increase in salaries in the last 2 years, last biennium, Ms. Payne?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we have not.
Okay.
Second, Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had an increase in the amount of money that are subsidized your benefits in the last 2 years, Ms. Payne?
Ms. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, okay.
And that would be a question for MMB.
Okay.
Any other questions? Ms. Payne, Mr. Edblatt, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, I'll call the Commissioner Jack Davies, Commissioner Robert Tennyson to present to the committee on behalf of the Uniform Laws Commission.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis. I'm a member of the Uniform Law Commission. Commissioner Jack Davies is going to do the presentation this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davies.
I'm Jack Davies, Commissioner on Uniform State Law. I'm the senior member of the Minnesota delegation. The Uniform Laws Commission is fairly well known around the legislature because we work for the legislature. The organization began in 1892, and since then has been drafting legislation which is brought to the state legislatures around the country for enactment. And it's supported entirely or almost entirely by state dues, which are, of course, appropriated by state legislatures. The commissioners are all volunteers. None of them get paid any salary for the work as commissioners. We do it because we enjoy that kind of thing. We're all sort of twisted personalities in that way, I guess. Last year when I made the presentation to the Senate, I said, of course, we're all workaholics. And one of the senators said, that's for sure. So you understand what we're about. But it is great fun for us, and that's why hours and hours and hours of volunteer work is put in. There are about 350 commissioners across the country, total. Minnesota has 8. In addition to tapping into that, they're all lawyers, tapping into that lawyer input of the members, we also tap in on behalf of the state legislatures, the organizations that are interested in the legislation that we are working on trying to draft for legislature, as observers and advisors and just interested parties in the products we're working on, so we get that input too. And what we try to do is put together common sense legislation and try to put out some of the conflict so that the legislatures of the country are saved some of the fights that they might otherwise involved in. The products of the conference are almost entirely, or are really entirely, private law. That is the rules of law that relate to relationships between private parties. So the grand great product of the conference is the Uniform Commercial Code, which relates to the buying and selling of products and financial matters between private parties. But that's not all the conference is involved in. The Probate Code of Minnesota came from from the conference. And I think I'm going to end. Our appropriation. I should tell you what our appropriation is. Our appropriation is the dues of the conference, that what Minnesota pays for its share of the ongoing work of the conference. Now, what that covers is the small staff of 11 or thereabouts in Chicago, the expenses of that office, and the transportation costs of the commissioners to attend weekend drafting committee meetings. So I'm off this weekend to spend Friday and Saturday in the basement room of a hotel in Chicago to work on an act relating to what happens to legislative acts, court decisions, administrative rules, when they're never printed, when they're put on computers, so that they don't get lost, so they don't get messed up by corrupted. So it's really going to be an exciting meeting, an exciting weekend for me. So that's one thing. The other expense is the appropriation for paying the expenses of the Minnesota commissioners to attend the annual meeting of the conference, which is 8 days of work. This year it's going to be in Vail, Colorado, and we're not going to be able to economize at Vail like we sometimes are able to, but this time, and if you don't make that appropriation, we have to go free out of our own pockets in addition to taking our vacation time for doing that. So I yield to
Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
Mr. Tennis.
As a committee, you heard a presentation from Gene Henning, who's another commissioner, and myself earlier in the year about what the work of the conference does. And really, it's a bulwark of federalism. We provide a lot of the information and the resources to enable states to adopt laws that make it possible for states to maintain a body of law, such as the Commercial Code. Which otherwise would be preempted by the federal. You have to have a common law across the country of these sorts of transactions. The other thing I want to mention, Jack mentioned the funding of the conference. The conference is a bit Minnesota-centric right now because its president is Bob Stein, a former president former dean of the University Law School. The other management committee is the Scope and Program Committee, which screens projects. Judge Harriet Lansing is chair of that, and there's a legislative committee that is responsible for getting these acts passed across the country, and I chair that. And we have a small staff in Chicago, as Jack said. We've laid off some of the staff over the last couple of years to economize. I'm responsible for the legal staff in Chicago. We have four lawyers who are responsible for getting legislation passed. You can imagine it takes a lot of time. I think last year I spent over 400 hours of my time working on conference work. And we don't get paid, and we don't want to get paid. We also don't get per diems. And when we go to the annual meeting, we get part of our expenses paid. We don't get them all paid because the food limit's like $35 a day, and you can't eat all for that. The days at the conference, I spend the first day there as an executive committee. It's a full day. The next day is a meeting. The next day is a full day meeting. We usually start at 8 in the morning. We don't get done until about 6 at night. And that's every day of the week, except Sunday we get the afternoon off. We usually go to a resort or some place where we get a deal. And we did get a deal in Vail. I'll tell you, I think our room rate's like $180. But we have to have a room big enough, or a place big enough to accommodate all of the people, the 300-some people. We need a large conference room to debate these acts. Because when the acts are presented, after the committee's worked for a couple years and developed an act, it's read to the entire body, line by line, in the committee of the whole, and debated. So the committee's sitting there on a dais defending their work or answering questions, and they take a lot of what if this, what about that, it's unclear, this and that sort of thing. And then they spent another year after the first reading going back and reworking the acts to accommodate the issues that have been raised. And then it's brought back and read another time, line by line. So you imagine sitting in a legislature, and you're all in the committee of the whole, reading an act line by line and debating it. And that's what we do. So it's the products come out pretty thoroughly vetted. We also, as Jack mentioned, work with other organizations. We don't undertake a drafting of an act unless we've gotten participation from the American Bar Association, in some cases the American Law Institute, and then any group that's interested in that topic, we solicit their participation. I'll give you an example. When we did the Securities Act, I was on the committee, the State Securities Act, and most of that's federal, but there's a layer of state law dealing with fraud mostly. But we'd have 45 people in a room, and about 8 of them or 9 of them were commissioners. The rest of them were from the industry, the state regulators, the SEC, the Federal Reserve, investment advisory company, and so on. And the list is pretty extensive, and they all sit around a table like this, and they participated in the discussion, because our ability to draft an act effectively is to make sure we have the input from everybody that knows what's going on. And that's how we put it together, because that's how we figure it out. But anyway, so in terms of our appropriation, in the conference, I serve on the executive committee as well as the scope of program and chair of the other committee. We have other resources. We created a foundation about 10 years ago, and it's basically funded by commissioners. We have an annual fundraiser at the event, and we do things. When a commissioner passes on, they often ask that a donation be made to the foundation, so we've got a couple $1 million in that now. But that's the small potatoes, and we're trying to build that up so we have some revenues. We also do license some of our products to West and to LexisNexis and other publishers. So we get, in the last 5 years, we've got some revenues from that, but that's really it. And we've, as I mentioned, laid off some staff to comment. We've also reduced the number of committees we've had meetings for, because meetings cost money. And so we've done that. But we've created some good products, and we have 4 acts this year that we're pushing. Be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Focus on the dues and put a dollar amount on it. Of your total budget, can you tell me or detail how much is paid in dues or owed on a monthly, yearly basis? Explain
the,
that.
Mr. Chairman, Member of the Committee, the dues for Minnesota, and the dues are based basically on the population of the state, but they're in tiers. Our dues are $51,200 a year. Minnesota has not paid that. We took cuts in our appropriations the last few years, as everybody else did. In 2010, the amount paid in dues was $22,039. And in 2011, $24,803, some odd cents. So we've not been paying our full dues.
How much is owed in dues arrearage?
Well, the amount would be roughly $26,000 for 2011 and $29,000 2010. That would be the past dues that weren't paid.
I'm curious, what's the National Uniform Laws Commission do? How long do they let you ride for half freight before stuff happens?
Let me answer, as long as your conscience would allow you to.
We have a very active, Mr. Chairman, we have a very active effort to make sure states to pay their dues. And this is not a unique problem in Minnesota. It's happened before. And my job as chair of the legislative committee is sometimes to work with states to get that money paid.
Last question on the dues that I have here is who exactly sets those dues amounts, and what input do you have in that process?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the executive committee of the conference sets the dues, and I've served on the executive committee for the last 6 years, I think the last time they were changed was about 6 years ago, but they'll be revalued again next year or this summer probably because of the new census. So the states will be reassessed in that sense. So we have an input into that, but it was done in tiers, and a former president really worked out the mechanics of that.
Thank you, sir.
The total amount of the dues from all of the states is really determined by what the needs of legislatures are for drafting from the conference. We are involved to a significant extent at this time with the impact of the internet on various fields of where new law is needed. The demand for the Uniform Acts is really very, very high. Well, that needs you need more dues because you need more activity out of the conference. So that's one of the things that influence. If we get shortchanged too much, the production from the conference drops off, and the society suffers because difficult issues don't have as good law as they could otherwise have.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly on the dues, did you say was yearly dues at $51,200, or is that for a biennium amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's an annual.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else from the committee at this time? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Davies and Mr. Tennyson, from your report, I noticed there are 9 commissioners from Minnesota. Is that set in statute, or how is that determined?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the statute, there are two parts to that. There are 3 commissioners appointed by the governor, the chief justice, and attorney general, and appointed concurrently. The revisor of statutes is a commissioner by virtue of the position. Under the rules of the conference and also under Minnesota law, if you've been a commissioner for 20 years, and you can ask the national conference for life membership, and so there are 5 of us are life members, usually if you ask for life membership, you get to be a life member unless you've got real horses or something else.
Very good. Anyone else? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
This time I'm going to call forward Jerry Lane, Gary Hurd to present to the committee on behalf of Civil Legal Services.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning, gentlemen. Tell us who you are and go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, Leader Johnson, members of the committee, I'm Jeremy Lane. I'm the recent former executive director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. And joining me today to help answer questions is Gary Hurd, Chief Operating Officer of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. We represent the 2 largest providers of civil legal services in Minnesota, and we appreciate the opportunity to appear today to talk about our role in helping to advance the state's constitutional obligation to provide access to justice. I'd like to touch briefly on a number of things. We've tried to organize our remarks to respond to some of the questions and presentation outline that you provided everybody. Because the legal services programs are not state agency, we've tried to adapt our remarks as best we can to suit the questions. We'd like to touch on the purpose and structure of legal services in Minnesota, talk about the impact of the services, provide an overview of sources of revenue, including some detailed information about the revenue that comes from state-administered funds, and finally talk about the challenges and implications posed by the governor's budget recommendations and other possible budget scenarios. Your packet should have the handout of this presentation. The statutory basis for the Civil Legal Services appropriation is cited. It's one of the ways the state fulfills its obligation to provide access to justice to Minnesotans of limited financial means. Implementation and oversight of the state funding for civil legal services is assigned to the Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee. The statute authorizes funding for services addressing a range of civil legal services matters. It pays some special attention to family farmers, and the legislation has traditionally included in the appropriation a portion of the funds to be used specifically to support family law services. The Supreme Court, in partnership with the civil legal services programs from throughout the state, has created a system that reaches every corner of the state and all of your districts. The Minnesota Legal Services Coalition is comprised of the 7 regional legal assistance programs which service all 87 counties among us. Another 24 programs do receive assistance to serve special communities and focus on special practice needs. State funds also support the infrastructure for coordinating and facilitating involvement of private lawyers in helping to serve low-income clients in every county in the state. When we appeared before this committee a few weeks ago, we described the kinds of services offered through the Civil Legal Services programs. Our services are income-tested. Because we cannot help all eligible persons with valid claims, our boards of directors adopt priorities, so our efforts are focused on the most critical legal needs, such as safety, shelter, and medical care. We help approximately 53,000 families directly last year, primarily women, children, and persons with disabilities. We reached hundreds of thousands of more through educational programs and web-based services. What we did not discuss last time was a picture of our case mix. As you can see from the graph, nearly half of our work is keeping families safe and helping people to remain secure in their homes, along with a range of other matters. The goal of our services is twofold. One is to assure that all Minnesotans, to the extent we can, have access to the justice system, but also that those services have a beneficial impact on the state and its citizens. Our services help the justice system function better and at lower cost by screening out non-meritorious cases, by helping clients find alternative resolutions other than a court appearance if they do have meritorious claims, and reducing the number of parties that appear before the courts without representation. I think any judge will tell you that the unrepresented litigant is glue in the gears of justice. They slow the whole system down. Beyond making the system more efficient, these services break the cycle of domestic violence. They also help prevent crime in communities by creating more stable homes, especially for families with at-risk youth. We also help Minnesota's seniors and disabled citizens secure health and financial supports that they need. The services and benefits provided by the Civil Legal Services programs are supported by a mix of private sources, federal funds, and state funds. In 2008, the last year for which complete data is available, this combination of resources was roughly $38.4 million. As you see, nearly a third of those resources are private. In addition to the dollar resources, however, about $15 million worth of pro bono legal services are provided by private lawyers through the coordination and support of our program staff, which screen cases for them and provide backup for them. I'd like to touch briefly on the 3 state-administered sources of funding. In fiscal 12, starting this July, that funding mix includes, number one, the state general fund, which is $11.8 million at the moment, and that's about 83% of the state-administered funds. Number two is IOLTA, interest on lawyer trust accounts. That's going to be $500,000, which is about 4%. And the attorney registration fee revenues, those are currently $1.8 million, or about 13% of the state-administered funding, unless that source is cut by one-third, which is on the table, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Let me talk about what's happening to each of these revenue streams. General fund support for legal services is currently $11.8 million a year. This is the level requested going forward by Civil Legal Services and the amount included in the governor's recommended budget for fiscal 12 and 13. However, as the graph shows, general fund support for legal services has declined already by 11% since 2008. This was a disproportionately larger reduction than was experienced in other parts of the justice system. Civil legal services is the only part of the justice system with base funding below 2006 in real dollars. A second key source of funding has been interest on lawyers' trust accounts, which we refer to as IOLTA. This was established by the Supreme Court in 1982 in Minnesota. Lawyers holding small or short-term deposits of their clients' funds place those funds in a pooled interest-bearing account. The interest is then forwarded by the bank to the Supreme Court and used almost entirely to support civil legal services. In more normal years, IOLTA grants were over $2 million a year. In 2008, they were $2.6 million in grant allocations. Unfortunately, the decline in the economy, both in terms of attorney business activity and lower bank interest rates, has had a catastrophic effect on IOLTA allocations. And the graph reflects, unfortunately, not just a projection, but a certainty, which is that there will be a 77%, which is $1.7 million a year, reduction, which is going to hit us 4 months from now on July 1st. And that is on top of an 18% IOLTA hit, which we took for the same reason in fiscal 2010. And I'll talk shortly about the impact of that revenue loss. The third source of state-administered funding for civil legal services is the attorney registration fee. For 13 years in Minnesota, at the request of the bar of the lawyers in Minnesota, the Supreme Court has designated $50 of their annual registration fees to support civil legal services for low-income Minnesotans. In 2009, again with the support of the State Bar Association, the court increased that fee by another $25 to support legal services. However, that increase is scheduled to sunset 4 months from now. We have filed a petition to extend that $25 fee increase indefinitely. That extension request received the unanimous support of the State Bar Association's Governing Assembly. The matter is awaiting a decision by the court. We, of course, hope they will approve it, but we have no control over that decision. If it is not approved, we will take a $600,000 hit in our current funding on July 1st. Summing that up, the general fund support for legal services has gone down 11% in the last 3 years, resulting in a reduction of attorney staff and capacity to help our clients. IOLTA allocations are going to go down $1.7 million in 4 months, which will further reduce our staffing, and the future funding of the attorney registration fee is a question mark. If it's not maintained, we'll take a $600,000 loss in 4 months. As funding and capacity have shrunk in recent years, the number of full representation cases we are able to carry has gone down almost 10%. And we ask you to keep in mind that before that happened, we were able to meet less than one half of the need, meaning people who were eligible for services and had decent claims. We have tried to the extent possible to provide at least advice or very brief help even when we are no longer able to take on a case for full representation. These are clients we know need more, but we simply cannot provide it. And the result is that the quality of justice is simply being degraded, and further cuts will just make that worse. Budget scenarios with no reduction in general fund support. State-funded legal services will take an almost 11% hit in state funding because of the IOLTA loss. If the attorney registration fee go down, add another 3.8% to that loss of state-level funding. Mr. Chairman, you asked us to consider the impact of general fund reductions of 15 and 20%. A 15% general fund reduction would double that already certain 10.75% cut in state-funded services. A 20% general fund reduction would turn that 10% loss, which we're 10.75% loss, we're already facing Toyota into a 25.7% loss of state-funded capacity. Our best-case scenario, Mr. Chairman, which is level general fund dollars, still means less justice and a less efficient justice system. In short, the Civil Legal Services request for a flat general fund appropriation could be called a harmless recommendation, but only for one leg of the three-legged stool of state-administered funds. And even that leg is shorter than it was in 2006 because of recent reductions. The other legs of the stool, one of them is just broken, and the third is shaky. As suggested here in a quote from District Court Judge Dave Knutson, improving efficiency is a way of doing business in legal aid. We've been managing and adapting to budget reductions for more than a decade. We have made staff and service cuts. We have also made helpful adjustments. We've implemented screening processes that allow us to prioritize and focus on critical legal needs cases. We have developed shared training and support services. We've created technology efficiencies. But the simple reality is, and the data that showed the reduction in direct representation services showed this dramatically, budget reductions are no longer anything we can manage around. They are forcing us to reduce core services, an aspect of our services that is vitally important not only to our clients, but is one of the main ways that we relieve cost and burden on the courts by keeping bad cases out and taking good cases and settling them rather than having them tried. This is on top of the chronic challenges and tight finances have created for the legal services system, the challenge to sustain a high-value return that you get from attorneys with the lowest compensation in the justice system, and the fact that even before recent cuts, we had the capacity to serve only 50% of the people who need us and come to us. Those numbers are going up. We have seen a 40% increase in recent years in requests for services brought on by the impact of the recession and the fact that people who were never poor before are poor now. Mr. Chairman, as you know, we in Civil Legal Services have been proud of the fact that we have worked over the decades to develop every possible public and private funding source. We believe it has been a strength that we have built a strong public-private partnership. That very strength, however, might invite someone to suggest that we go to those other sources to make up revenue losses. The problem, Mr. Chairman, is that they are all bleeding. This is an economic perfect storm for us. Foundations, which we go to, took a 30% hit in the meltdown. United Ways have taken major hits. The largest United Way in Minnesota has had to reduce the pool of money that we will be able to apply for by one-third, and so my program alone faces an almost certain $250,000 cut in United Way funding, and that's a relationship for my program that goes back, well, long before I was born, to about 1917. Local governments, as you all know, are in deep financial holes. The private bar is taking hits. I'm proud of the fact that many of our private bar donors, at a time when they are laying off their own staff, are maintaining their support for legal services in the face of those internal cuts. We talk all the time to people in other parts of the country looking for new ideas for funding, public or private. The problem for us is that they are still catching up to Minnesota in areas like tapping attorney registration fees and private bar support. In short, Mr. Chairman, there is no place else for us to go. And if there was, Mr. Chairman, I think you know me well enough to know that we would be all over it. Mr. Chairman, you are one of the longest-serving members of this body. And this is my 30th year of working with this legislature to build and maintain a partnership in support of justice. As you know, our state constitution says every person is entitled to obtain justice. That's a powerful promise. When you and your colleagues took your oath of office, you became guardians of that promise. When I took my oath as an attorney in Minnesota, I took on a responsibility to help to keep that promise. As of last week, I stepped down from my position as executive director, so this may be my last chance to say publicly that it has been a privilege to work with you and your colleagues over the last 30 years. Over those years, sometimes this body was able to help us, and sometimes it wasn't, and we have understood that. We both understand that Article 1, Section 8 of the state constitution does not create a constitutional right to counsel in civil cases, but I think we share the belief that civil legal services for those who cannot pay is an essential part of any effort by this state to keep its promise, just as are the courts and the public defenders and the county attorneys and all the other parts of what Chief Justice Gilday calls the justice ecosystem. As you struggle to meet the enormous challenges that you face this year, I know you may not be able to move us all closer to keeping that promise. I only hope that you may be able to find a way to avoid moving farther away. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hurd and I will be happy to answer any questions you or members of the committee may have, either now or later.
Mr. Hurd, Mr. Lane, thank you. Not only for your testimony today, but also your service to justice.
It's been a privilege.
In the state of Minnesota. I will lead off with a few questions, and then the committee, if it has additional questions, we'll go to that. I note on slide 5 of your presentation, you indicate 12% of your cases in 2009 involved immigration. Can you explain the nature of those cases?
Yeah, I think Gary will.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are a variety of different types of immigration cases that the agencies funded by the general state appropriation perform. As you may know, Minnesota has been a very popular state for refugees and asylees to come from other countries, starting with the Hmong who came after the end of the Vietnam War. As people come to the United States with as an asylee or a refugee, they need to adjust their status to become a lawful permanent resident or get their green card. And so we help people in that adjustment process. Once people on the track to citizenship have their green card, the next step is for them to naturalize as a U.S. citizen. And we also help people in that process. Another area that we work in with some specific funding from the federal government is to assist victims of domestic violence who are immigrants to the country. And so there's a special visa process and potential adjustment and naturalization process for them.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add a couple of notes based on my knowledge of my own program services. Some of what we have done is in the area of family reunification. Sometimes one member of a family, one of the parents, may emigrate to the United States and make a home here. But while their family remains divided with some of their family members in refugee camps overseas, that family is not only divided on a human level, it's divided on an economic level, so that somebody who may be struggling with a low-wage job here is sending some of that very limited income to help keep their families alive in those refugee camps. And so if we're able to help them reunify the families here, it's not only a good thing, obviously, on a purely human level, but it strengthens those families economically, which means that some of those families' resources are not being sent out of the state, and it gives the whole family a better chance of succeeding economically. Some of what we do involves complications establishing age and relationships, because some of the families coming from countries with very poor or no infrastructure, it's very hard to document when a child was born and the parentage and so on, and so we try to help with that. Some of the services reflected in the chart also reflect services funded by other grants. My program gets a grant, for example, from a foundation specifically to work with immigrant women who are victims of domestic violence. That is unfortunately a problem which a number of families experience being new to our culture, and so we try to help alleviate the consequences of that violence and help people sometimes restructure their lives.
Thank you. I want to pursue this a little further. We're often reminded that immigration is a federal matter, yet the largest single source of your revenue is state general funding. So along with the IOLTA interest and attorney registration fees as well, do you have a system in place, or can you envision one where you would prioritize which cases are of state civil legal matters versus non-state issues such as immigration and focus state and local resources on those cases, and thereby perhaps reducing that 12% bar column?
Mr. Chairman, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, our priorities are ultimately set by our boards of directors, who are made up of local attorneys and other citizens living in the communities we serve. They do set priorities. In terms of immigration being a federal problem, that is, it is true in the sense of being governed heavily by federal law. The consequences of the legal problems, however, are experienced right here. And as I say, you know, domestic violence, if a immigrant woman is a victim of domestic violence, she may wind up in a shelter which is funded locally, not from any place out of state. And so the consequences of some of these problems are experienced locally. Obviously, we can adapt to any changes in the funding structure or restrictions placed on it. I would encourage the committee to keep in mind, however, that the impact of the problems we're dealing with is local.
Mr. Lane, by your own presentation, I'm going to rephrase my question. 12% of your cost goes to immigration cases. Looking at your entire dollar amount of your budget, 12% of your budget is roughly $2 to $2.5 million. Can you envision a system whereby you would prioritize cases dealing with immigration issues versus state civil legal matters, and thereby allow you to focus on state civil legal matters?
Mr. Chair, we could certainly work with you in the committee if you had some specific ideas as to doing that. Different programs have different funding streams. Some of them are heavily local and private. Some of them are more significantly federal. And I think what you're seeing here is a roll-up of all of the programs. So the answer would probably vary from program to program. But we could certainly prioritize how state funds are used to reflect that concern, if that was your wish.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Hurd.
In addition, I don't want the committee to be mistaken by the statistics. Those are percentage breakouts of the number of cases and don't necessarily reflect the amount of resources that go into those particular areas. As you know, Mr. Chairman, as an attorney, a case is not a case. And some cases in family law where we have contested custody cases take considerably more time and resources than some of these other cases that are more administrative, like immigration matters.
Well, on that note then, Mr. Hurd, would you be able to revisit slide number 5 and give us a revised slide showing the percent of person hours 12% represents?
I can for some of the programs. Some of the programs do not keep timekeeping to that level, but we can certainly get you a much more accurate picture of where our resources go.
Review your slide 5 hopefully by Thursday or at least next week. Give us a revised percentage bar graph showing person hours consumed by those various bar columns. 2 or 3 more questions, and then Representative Hillstrom on this point.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. As you're revising the graph, it would be helpful if you would also show which dollars that were spent on these subjects actually came from state money or which ones were grants. because, for example, immigration tends to be a hot and controversial issue at times around the legislature. And it would be helpful for the members to know if the money that you spent on those items were private or if they were state dollars. Frankly, I don't want to see language in the budget bill that simply says you may not spend or you may not do these kinds of cases if, in fact, what you're doing is using private dollars or using outside resources. And I think that might be some of where the questioning may lead us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsen, we'll give it our best shot.
Mr. Lane, on that note, do you have a feel for a number right now of your dollars coming in? What percent of those dollars are earmarked by the giver to be spent only on certain kinds of cases?
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I'm stepping down is that my memory ain't what it used to be, and it wasn't that good before. I can try to get that, but what's left in here is not at that level of detail.
Well, would it be safe to say 5% or less of your money you received is earmarked by the donor? And if you don't know, see if you can revisit that issue.
Yeah, I don't trust myself to give an answer that I'd ask you to trust.
That's fine. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that, I was just going to say maybe they could just actually give us that information on Thursday when they revisit this slide.
Very good. I've got a couple more questions, then we're going to go to committee. Shifting gears, can you tell me, either one of you, how much you spend on promotional materials or advertising in general, such as brochures? What do you have an advertising line item in your budget?
No, Mr. Chair, that's the short answer. I never thought of anything we did as being promotional. The closest I can come to that is that we do educational materials, but I'm not sure that's the question you're asking. We do, and have for as long as I've been doing this work, try to provide clear, plain language information on people's rights and responsibilities, whether it's in renting an apartment or going to small claims court or applying for unemployment compensation or buying a car or you name it. That is not intended to be promotional. It's certainly not intended to be advertising. But when you distribute information, people will get it, and then they will have questions, and so they'll call us. So educational materials that we put out have the effect, I think, of leading people to us. The irony is, of course, that unlike a lot of law firms, we don't have and don't need market development. We have a client population that we can't conceivably serve. And so although we feel it's our responsibility to try to get accurate information out there, even if it may generate more requests for our assistance, we think we have to do it anyway because most of the people who need our help are never going to get inside the door. We do have web-based services, not, again, to advertise, but to get information out there, some of it aimed at our clients, plain language, simple information that they can hopefully use themselves to avoid problems or solve them without a lawyer. Some of it is used by private and public social service agencies, county case managers and so on, domestic violence shelters, homeless shelters, and those people repeatedly tell us that sometimes the information they get from us is the only clear and accurate information they get, and so they're also the result of our providing that information not only is to help them do their jobs, but also sometimes leads them to us. But I would never have described it as promotional or advertising.
Last question from myself. Are you currently serving any clients that do not meet the definition of eligibility under statute?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The statute that we drafted in 1982 reflected the fact that even back then we had significant numbers of clients being served under different funding streams. And those funding streams defined eligibility differently from the state of Minnesota or from the United Way and so on. I'll give you two easy, fairly large examples. Most of the programs get funding under Title III of the Federal Older Americans Act. That's a statute to provide services for senior citizens. By federal law, that is not a means-tested program. It is not limited by federal law to senior citizens under 125% of the poverty line, which is the typical state and United Way guideline. And so in 1982, it was important for us to be able to distinguish those clients we were serving with that federal funding stream, where we are not permitted to screen people out for income. We are permitted, and our boards of directors are permitted, to prioritize by problem category so that we could give top priority, for example, to a senior citizen facing homelessness as opposed to a senior citizen, you know, wanting a trust created for their children. The latter problem, they are quite likely to be able to go to a private attorney and get that problem dealt with. The homelessness issue is likely to affect a low-income senior. So we can prioritize substantively, but it is not a means-tested program. Similarly, my program gets a federal stream of money to serve persons with disabilities, such as mental retardation, cerebral palsy, autism, traumatic brain injury, and so on, with legal problems arising out of that disability. So some of our work is in the area of special education and so on. Some of it is helping persons with disabilities get retraining through the workers' voc rehab system in Minnesota. That is not an economically means-tested program, again, by federal mandate. So it was important to us, and it continues to be important, to be able, with those funding streams, to serve clients who may not fit the definition of eligibility for services with state-appropriated dollars. The fact is that the overwhelming majority of clients, even those being served with those other funding streams, are low-income. Persons with disabilities are disproportionately the most economically disadvantaged in the state. And the overwhelming majority of our senior clients, even those served with other funding streams, are in fact low income and would meet the definition of eligible client, but the statute was drafted to make it clear that those funding streams would not be jeopardized, and our ability to serve clients with those separate funding streams would continue.
Mr. Lane, do you receive any money from Hennepin County?
Mr. Chair, we do. Not as much as we used to.
How much?
More than 60 and less than 100,000.
Any other counties across the state contribute?
Boy, for some years we got some money up in Isani, Chisago, and Kennebec, but that went away a few years ago.
That's good. Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, back to the issue of the immigration cases that you handle. If your organization was to stop handling those, what other resources are available in the state to handle those kinds of legal issues and those clients, if you can?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't know that there are other providers who do not receive any funding from or through the state. So I don't honestly know. If we were unable to serve those people with any funding stream, I think most and perhaps all of them would have to go without.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a battered woman who needs the services that you described basically would just be on her own. Is that what you're telling us?
In terms of legal assistance, that is possible. As I say, you know, some programs serving battered women do receive a small piece of the state funding. So the ability to provide services, the difference in the impact would depend on whether a restriction just applied to the state funds or if it applied to any organization that received the state funds, even with other funds like the foundation grant that we get.
Representative Cornish, then Johnson. Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's been a whole bunch of interesting questions since I had my own here, but
Representative Liebling's question, there's plenty of sources out there to help with battered women. I don't think we have to result to civil legal services. Battered women shelters all over the place, and they do receive state funding. And victim services boards and all sorts of help. We hand out cards to all the battered women that we take care of in our police department, make sure that they're well taken care of. I think this committee has got to see the problem with illegal immigration that the chair brought up. Civil legal services here today, we're putting money into it. The other day it was $3 million from the courts for interpreters. We got health care costs. Our local jails are many illegal immigrants that are costing us money. The battered women shelters that you brought up have numbers of illegal aliens inside those. And because other countries treat their women differently than we do, and they come over here, and it's amazing the abuse that takes place, and we end up paying for it because they're here. And so this is just, I hope you see how this is mounting up and up and up, the illegal immigration problem that we have with the illegal aliens. Now, back to my question. I have a problem with your organization in that even when you were well-funded, public defenders were making the claim that you were adjusting your funding by turning down cases. And I've had some problems with people in my district that have been turned down on cases with civil legal services. And I have a problem with a local board making the decision on the priority of the claims and also you defining what is meritorious and what is not. And so my question is, how do you answer some of those claims about those perceived ideas of how your organization is operated, and the difference between you and the public defenders is they can't sort out what cases they take. They're mandated to take cases. However, you folks can make that decision based on a number of different things, your interpretation of what's meritorious and your funding and other things. So do you keep track, a log in specific, of the cases that you refuse to take so that we could find out how many cases you are refusing, for what reasons, and what do you, your definition of meritorious is? And so that's a roundabout question, is how do you answer some of these claims that you can adjust your funding base by the cases that you take or that you refuse, and how do you account for the cases that are turned down? How do we find out what those are like?
Ms. Delane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, let me start by saying I didn't intend to mislead in responding to Representative Liebling's question. I tried to restrict my answer to legal services. Domestic violence victims obviously get many other services that have nothing to do with us, and so I was trying to restrict my answer just to access to legal counsel. With regard to the difference between civil legal services and the public defender, it is absolutely true that a critical difference, and that affects how they do business and how we do business, is that subject to the problem which is starting to surface, which is lawyers saying, I cannot ethically carry the caseload I'm carrying and do a competent job, that's an issue the public defense system is facing, because they are generally mandated to handle all comers, regardless of what would normally be called the merit of their defense. Civil legal services has always been able to say to somebody who comes into us, a bad thing may have happened to you, but the law has not been violated. You have no legal claim here, and so we're not going to sue anybody for you. Or in the case of a tenant who may be facing eviction, they didn't pay their rent. There was no excuse for their not paying their rent. Not legal excuse, you know, they may have been laid off or something, but the bottom line is, if you owe the rent and you haven't paid the rent, we're not going to go to court to defend a case where there is no defense. And that is actually, I think, one of the benefits, in my experience, of the difference between the civil and criminal systems. And I think the courts will tell you one of the benefits of what we do is that a person can come to us and ask us, do I have a claim here? And they will trust our answer because we're on their side. And so if we say to a tenant, you're going to be evicted, you better spend the next week finding someplace else to live instead of trying to figure out what you're going to say in court, and save the court's money, whether it's in terms of defending a case that can't be defended or in terms of bringing a claim pro se, because they think somebody else did them wrong, whether it was a private party or a government agency. If we tell them you have no claim, they are far less likely to clog up the court system. Now, some of the people to whom we say that, we say, you have no legal claim here, but we also, while they're sitting in our office, say, here is something else you can do, whether it's in terms of finding other housing or in terms of dealing with a loan that they're in default on. We can try to give them advice to steer them in a more constructive direction than the court system. And so sometimes we will give advice to somebody in the process of telling them their claim doesn't belong in court. And I think we assist in the efficiency of the justice system by being able to do that. The definition of merit, I'll give it a shot. It doesn't mean an absolute slam dunk sure winner, and it clearly does not mean a 1 in 1,000 chance. In fact, one of the things I use in screening potential employees is presenting them a hypothetical scenario in which they have sympathetic facts. The client's situation is sad, and they maybe didn't do anything terrible. But when the lawyer does an analysis of the law as applied to the facts of their case, they don't see any viable legal claim. And in those situations, the lawyer who may say, well, I would file a claim in court because the client wanted me to, even though it appears that the court would throw the case out, those are the people I screen out from employment. I don't want somebody who's going to take sympathetic facts and bad law and waste the court's time or our very scarce resources bringing a case they know they're going to lose. As any lawyer will know, there's a huge gray area somewhere between a sure loser and a sure winner. We try to make a judgment on a case-by-case basis geared to the probability of success, the resources a case would require, whether there's any potential alternative source of representation, and make a judgment. That judgment is always driven by the fact that if we say yes to client one, we're going to say no to client two because we can't represent them both. And so we have absolutely no motivation to waste time on long shots. And we do keep statistics in terms of turning away cases. It won't be a perfect measure because, as I said, sometimes when we talk to a potential client, we say, your case doesn't belong in court, it has no legal merit, but you can go do the following three things to try to improve your situation, and we'll close that case as an advice only, because the advice may have been, don't go to court, but it was to do something else that might be a more constructive way to spend their time. So some cases that we make a judgment, we're not going to represent them in court. We may give them advice to go in a different direction. So not every case that we say to a client, you're going to lose if you go to court, that may not show up in a straight, just turn down, send them away. I don't know if you...
All right, we have Representative Johnson, then Lesh, then I think we're going to move along. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I've heard is that an unrepresented litigant slow down the system dramatically. I assume that an unrepresented immigrant litigant would slow down the system dramatically as well. Is that any reason not to believe that's the case? I mean, that's one of our big concerns is how the system's getting clogged up.
Mr. Lane.
Am I misunderstanding it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that is true. We have experienced over the last, well, since 1970, not 72, when Hmong population started showing up with refugees in significant numbers, representing even, you know, totally legal immigrants with language problems makes a case more expensive. It takes twice as long because basically everything has to get said twice in every conversation, both in our office and in the courtroom. So I have enormous sympathy for the courts and have sometimes in front of legislative committees encouraged recognition of the fact that, totally separate from any problem relating to legality, serving people who are limited English speakers or non-English speakers makes any legal process significantly more time-consuming, and in the court system, obviously, time is money. So, yeah, any problems will be made significantly worse by the need for interpretive services, both before you get to court and in court.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Mr. Chair, with respect to the attorney registration fees, just so I understand it, the Supreme Court will be reviewing whether to renew that particular fee. Is that something they have to make a decision on, or can they just let it slide and then after July 1st it expires? How does that work exactly?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no, they have to make a decision. Let me back up. Theoretically, they could simply ignore the petition which has been filed and not make a decision either way. Unfortunately for us, not making a decision is making a decision, because the $25 fee increase that was adopted in 2009 self-destructs on July 1st. So if the Supreme Court does nothing, that $600,000 a year goes away. I have never heard of the court not deciding a petition that was brought before it. So I expect they will either say yes, it will continue, and if they say yes, it will continue, they could put another sunset on it for 2 years from now. We have asked that they not do that. The lawyers of Minnesota have asked that they not do that, have said that they want this fee to continue open-ended, as the one from 13 years ago has done. That was adopted with no termination date, so it remains in effect unless the court changes it. The $25 was different. We hope they will not, even if they do continue it. I'd certainly rather yes for 2 years than no, but we have asked them not to sunset it this time.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regarding the IOLTA budget, is the expectation that's going to remain at that low level, even given the improving economy and the like? Do you project out the next 4 years to be similarly reduced?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, one of the benefits of hanging around as long as I have is that you see what I call the sine wave of the economy. You know, and there was a bad time 15 years ago. It goes down. Our experience, unfortunately, is that things go down faster than they go back up. Particularly with the bank interest rates, they went down to effectively zero, and now in some cases with some banks literally 0% interest. When the economy turns around, eventually those rates will creep back up, but my experience is that is a very slow process. The Supreme Court Legal Services Advisory Committee tried to cushion the coming downturn by setting aside funds into reserves, so they just didn't give away all the money they had as soon as they had it. And so that's why 2 years ago we took an 18% hit when some people in other parts of the country were taking a 30 or 40% hit from their IOLTA funds. The problem is that they have now wiped out that reserve, and so part of the rebuilding process will be for them to rebuild that reserve. So we think that probably for the next 4 years, it is likely to be where it is now, at that $500,000 a year level. 4 years from now, it might start creeping back up, but they will rebuild it slowly because they have learned from now two dramatic instances of funds going from over $2 million to down to $500,000 that it's crazy not to try to level out those peaks and valleys. For the grantee's sake, among others.
Very good. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lane, you mentioned a point at which public defenders are now looking at possibly being well beyond their ethical considerations of handling more clients than they ethically should be allowed to. I would posit that that occurred several years ago, that we're well past that. We're way into unethical territory at this point. However, my question is, with respect in the analogies made about the criminal system, I know that that bottleneck needs to be solved somewhere. And in that situation, the courts are able to solve the bottleneck in their own way by saying, well, we're just going to decriminalize and put a bunch of cases on the payables list. We're just not going to hear them anymore. It's no longer a crime. You can pay it. It's a minor offense. We're done. In the civil system, is there any equivalent action that's happened, either by the courts or anywhere else, to create that artificial bottleneck to slow down the caseload, other than the discussion that you've stated here already, which is, you know, I'm sorry, I just can't bring your case. Go find another way to solve it. Is there any other way that's solvable other than the actions you've described that your own agency performs?
Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chair, Representative, some of the things the court was talking about a couple of years ago included delaying or just not hearing, you know, small claim court cases. And small claims court was invented in Minnesota, I can't help saying this, at the request of a legal aid lawyer back in like 1920, because low-wage workers sometimes were being denied their wages and no lawyer could make a living on these very small cases. So the court was created as a place for people without much money to go without a lawyer, primarily, to handle cases that economically didn't make sense for the legal profession to handle. So, you know, if those cases start getting pushed back 6 months or something, justice will be functionally denied just by virtue of the delay. The reality also is that in terms of the judicial food chain of priorities, you know, civil cases are at the bottom of the list. And so if the court can't handle everything, they're just going to prioritize some of the types of cases that our clients experience down to the bottom of the list. And so just by virtue of delay, damage will be done. It's been well established in areas like domestic violence that if accountability is delayed, the violence gets worse. And so it's not just a matter of justice delayed being justice denied, but safety will be jeopardized. People's safety will be jeopardized by a delay in hearing OFP cases, order for protection cases. So there would be that impact of the court being forced to narrow what it does.
Any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not so much to the testifiers, but some statements were made a little bit earlier, and I really feel that we need to respond to them because, Representative Cornish, it seems that every time immigration is discussed here or anything that has to do with speaking English or such topics that you use the occasion to blame immigrants for a lot of things, a lot of problems that we have in the state. And I think it's very important, first of all, that we have to distinguish between illegal immigration and legal immigration. And what I heard here from the testifiers is that they provide services to legal immigrants for the most part, except in very special circumstances. So that's the first thing. But I think it's really important that we not confuse this, because I'm hearing now immigrants being blamed for a lot of things, a lot of our costs, and now even today for domestic violence. I think that's very, very unfair. A statement was made about health care costs, and I want to reiterate that we do not provide health care to illegal immigrants except in very, very narrow circumstances, such as pregnant women, whose babies, after all, are going to be American citizens when they're born here, like it or not. So I think it really, there needs to be a little pushback, Representative Cornish, and I would appreciate it if you don't want to hear this coming back to you, that you stick to the topic and not bring in all kinds of stuff about illegal immigration and blame immigrants. I have a district with many immigrants in it, and many of them are professionals. They're hardworking people. The ones who aren't professionals are hardworking people. Almost all of us come from immigrant backgrounds. Immigration has helped to build this country. So if you want to talk about illegal immigration, and it's very fair to talk about how we're using our state budget and who it should be used on, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have that discussion, but let's not blame immigrants for our costs, and let's not make statements that are absolutely untrue about spending money on illegal immigrants when we are not. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me make that statement.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cornish, and those in the audience for the House File 152, we are out of time, and I'm going to go to you in a second. We're out of time on that bill. I apologize. We have run over. We are in our budget hearings this week and next, and they will take precedence over hearing any bill, even though we may have it on the calendar. Representative Cornish, you have a minute for rebuttal.
Take less than that. Representative Liebling, if you and the governor want to keep your head in the sand about illegal immigration and illegal aliens, that's fine with me. One case in point, I asked the State Patrol to show up today to testify in my document, the illegal documents bill. I had a State Patrol officer that's assigned to ICE. I told him he didn't have to take a stance on the bill. All I wanted was factual information. The governor's office took back the State Patrol officer, would not let him testify today on the illegal documents bill, even though I wanted factual information. So people continue to treat this sensitive subject that we can't approach it. And illegal aliens are costing us a great deal of money. Interpreters all across the board from in the health care, they're dragging us down to health care in the emergency rooms, in the prisons. We have to provide health care. So if you folks want to ignore the problem or address it, it's up to you.
Mr. Hurd, Mr. Lane, thank you again for your service to the state. You had a lot of questions and answers, and we'll see you around the next few weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No further business. The Judiciary Policy Finance Committee stands adjourned.